get started. And I'm really pleased. This came about today as a result of, because John was with us back in, I believe it was the 1st of December. So it's not real long ago. And it was very enjoyable to hear what John had to share with us at that particular time. And it came to my attention because we're doing some promotional things with the 2010 Health Freedom Expo at the Long Beach Convention Center. It's happening in Long Beach here coming up the end of March, which is just a little over a month away. And, in fact, Republic Magazine has a booth there, Booth 512, and they're also having an event in Chicago in June. But the information about that particular event can be found at healthfreedomexpo.com. But when I looked over their list of speakers, some of them, the names really popped out at me, and particularly John Rappaport, because, I've followed his speaking at different events for quite a few years now, and I've noted that his research is quite good, and the things that he has to share are backed up by not just conjecture or wild speculation, but some solid research. And I feel that I can well trust what he has to share. So I wanted to bring John in to kind of kick off our cross-promoting that we're doing with the Health Freedom Expo, and we'll move along through the succeeding weeks with other presenters that are going to be part of that. But I'm glad John could be the first in that. And I'm going to go ahead and provide a little bit of background information on John. John Rappaport has been working as an investigative reporter for 20 years. Nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, John has written articles on politics, health, medical fraud, and the arts for LA Weekly, Spin Magazine, CBS Newswatch, Stern, In These Times, and more. He has hosted radio series in LA and Las Vegas on politics and health. John has given lectures and seminars all over the world on the question, who really runs the planet? He is the author of 7 books, including AIDS Incorporated and The Secret Behind Secret Societies. These days, operating from a new website, insolutions.info, that's insolutions.info, John remains on the cutting edge of breaking news and its deeper meanings. His recent work on the swine flu pandemic has blown the doors off the lies promoted by the U.S. government and the World Health Organization. John's acute insights and his comedic cuts at the establishment have made him a very busy man. And as a speaker, he is in great demand, and that's evidenced by the many places he has been speaking. And with that, I want to welcome John to be with us here today on the webinar. Hi, John.
Thanks, Earl. Great to be here.
Great. Well, it's really good to have you. And, I know we followed along a very specific line last time and in fact, operated with particular questions and a bit of a format. And, as we talked before, I wanted to open this up and maybe move in directions that you'd really like to get into and to have it just be kind of open. What would you say, John, would be something that you would consider very important, very relevant, that you really want to get out to the people listening today?
Well, there are so many things where to start. But one of the things that I think is important to bring up has to do with what's actually happened to swine flu since we spoke last. Because what I've noticed in covering these phony epidemics from SARS to bird flu to swine flu and various other attempts to scare the public is that when they end very quietly. And the reason they end very quietly is because nothing was really done, because there is no tremendous need for a retrospective report, a summing up of successes and so forth, because the whole thing has been based on a tissue of lies and hoaxes from the beginning. And so the public health agencies like the CDC and the World Health Organization and various governments just move right along to the next thing. They just leave that behind, and they hope that the blizzard of media publicity that they obtained the last time will sit in the minds of the public like a kind of residue memory, distorted memory, so that when the next so-called epidemic arrives, the public will actually think that the government helped them during the last one, that the CDC helped them during the last one, that the World Health Organization participated in some good way in the last one, simply because there was so much media coverage. That's very important to understand. It's almost like creating a path of false history for the public. It's almost like implanting false memories in the mind of the public about, quote, what happened last time, so that when this time happens, the public actually thinks that they ought to believe once again what the government is telling them. This is a key factor in propaganda, and I guess, therefore, what I'm really talking about here is how propaganda is done. You exit quietly from the last propaganda campaign. You try to leave a trace in the memory of the public that it was important, helpful, good. The responses of the government were good. And then when the next one comes along, you hope that you will be remembered fondly for what you did last time, and there will be some measure of trust that obtains. Well, this is one of the standard, but not very often understood, principles of propaganda. That's how it works. And the reason that it is successful to the degree that it is because if you control basically the media, then you can publicize 50, 100, 200, 500, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000, 20,000, 100,000 stories in the press about your point of view. And then the dissenters, the people who will say, well, I don't really believe this, their number of exposures to the public will be much, much smaller. And so in retrospect, it will seem to the majority of the public that they got a good shake from the government. They got the right word. They got the truth. The government was looking out for them. The health agencies really wanted to help. They weren't lying. This is how not just propaganda, but generation to generation propaganda works. This is how it plays out. And people should be aware of it, especially having gone through the swine flu fiasco, which was a fiasco for many reasons that I've detailed in articles and video. People should remember the truth rather than just the generality that was presented to them by the government. And if they did, we would be living in a much different world, you see. For example, people have been fooled time and time and time again by presidential elections. Every 4 years, the hysteria builds. This is the most important election that you'll ever experience in your lifetime. You must make the right choice. We stand on the brink, et cetera, et cetera. I've heard this going all the way back to 1964 in my lifetime. The same publicity, the same propaganda, and no matter who comes into office, one can count on the expansion of government like a fungus the increase in spending of the government, more taxes, therefore, more corruption, more invasive actions into the lives of private citizens, more nibbling away at the Bill of Rights. It doesn't matter which party wins the election. But the propaganda, you see, each time we've had an election, leaves that trace of a memory in the public mind that it was a very, very important choice that was being made at the voting booth. And so that is sort of resurrected and reinstated every 4 years, and people pay lip service to it and tend to believe it and act accordingly instead of backing off and saying, wait a minute. If we have seen the increased power, unconstitutional power, of the federal government increase in every single election since probably the first, then maybe we should reflect a bit on this. Maybe we should stand off to the side and say to ourselves, what is actually going on here? What are we being induced to believe by propaganda? And what can we do about it? How can we change the course of history and the course of government? That would be anti-propaganda. That would be people who are awake acting on what they discover on their own. And again, if that were the case for the majority of Americans, we would be living in a very different country, in a very different world right now.
Well, it certainly is true exactly what you're saying, because the way I have viewed it for a while, since I've been aware of a little bit more about what's going on, is that you have the same ruling elite, and they just, you know, they pretty much, it doesn't matter which one of their team players or their puppets gets in place. The same game is going to be pretty much played out, albeit sometimes a little bit more window dressing on it, or a little bit, you know, it looks like, oh, it's Democrat or it's Republican, it's whatever, you know, you think you're getting stuff. Maybe if it's a Democrat, there's going to be a little bit more talking about social programs. With Republican, you talk about a little bit more economic liberty, maybe reducing taxes or cutting, you know, this, that, or the other. Even though the languaging is there, it doesn't look like anything really happens substantive to make any changes in those areas or move in any way but the wrong direction. So I think that's what I hear you saying. And
it's, yes. Absolutely. And the litmus test is, what is happening to government itself? Forget who's in the White House. But what can be observed about government from generation to generation, from election to election? And as I said, you can observe a few things. One, it keeps getting bigger. It keeps on spending more. It becomes more invasive on the liberty of private individuals. And it keeps nibbling away at the Bill of Rights. Now, there are other commonalities as well, but those are some pretty big ones. And I think you can spot the signs that more people are waking up to this. There are people, for example, who are calling out for constitutional government, government that is run according to the dictates laid out by the founders in the Constitution. Well, that's not a bad thing. Now, some of them are really just propaganda types masquerading as patriots, but there are some honorable and sincere people in that increasing crowd who recognize that limited government was what was set down in the Constitution. And only through amending the Constitution would it be legal to change that notion? And in fact, the whole Constitution was written based, and I was just writing this on a blog this morning, some climate scientist was trying to say that the opposing sides in this scientific debate about whether global warming is real and man-made and so forth, that these opposite sides in the debate should somehow trust each other more, that we should somehow usher in a new era of trust instead of this combat that's been going on. And I pointed out in my comment on the blog that the Constitution was written by people who believed in distrust and disrespect. They believed in distrust of central power for good reason. They had all the examples of Europe on the table in front of them. They didn't want that. And so you could really view the entire document of the Constitution as an attempt to build in the checks and balances and limitations that would prevent government from becoming, unfortunately, what it has become. So people are waking up. They realize that we have been completely bamboozled and taken over by an ideology that is not friendly to personal freedom, to individual freedom. And you can call that ideology anything you want to. It masquerades under different names and titles and so forth. But when all is said and done, it is just naked power. It's a few people saying to a lot of people, we're going to control you. And in order to do that, we are going to say things and present ourselves in various different ways and guises. We are going to lie. We're going to tell half-truths. We're going to use very popular human sentiments as a kind of cover story to conceal our real motives. We're going to do all sorts of things. We're going to even sometimes present ourselves wrapped up in the flag and the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, whatever is necessary. But underneath it all, we have this agenda, and the agenda is power, control over other people. That's the game that they play. And in order to do this, they have a ready supply of people, politicians, and their supporters who want to enter the fray, who are cynical themselves to one degree or another, or honorable to one degree or another, or sincere to one degree or another, or ignorant or stupid or bright to one degree or another. But what they all share, these politicians, is that they want office. You know, they want to get elected. They want to win. And they have an agenda of some kind. And sometimes part of that agenda is sincere and sometimes it isn't. But it doesn't really matter, because from this ready supply of politicians, there will be common denominators. And the first of those common denominators is that government itself will become larger, more influential, more invasive, more powerful, more controlling. That is the game.
It seems that one of the things that's been used very effectively is fractionalizing people. Divide and conquer is the old technique, but getting people to get revved up behind certain labels, whether it's Democrat, Republican, right, left, whatever classification it may be, whatever line you fall on, and really stoking up those sides against each other and keeping people all occupied in the machinations of being such opposers and enemies and yay for my side and we've got to win and at all costs, and forgetting that while you're doing all of that, these guys are getting their way. They're doing all the stuff that they do. And I think the other danger that we've seen, and there's been a lot of discussion in the freedom movement about this, John, and you might want to comment on it, but it's where some of these operatives with money, power, and influence can, they'll see a grassroots movement, like whether it's Tea Party or whatever it is, and they'll try to start organizing it with the money and all the great knowledge and connections they have. And so the people say, yeah, why don't you lead it? Why don't you put this thing together? And the next thing you know, they're out front of it, leading it, and taking it in the wrong direction and keeping it marginalized where it can't be really effective. Or on the other hand, other people infiltrating it and creating factions that fight each other so that they're so busy using their energy and resources fighting that they're ineffective in their cause. So I don't know if you want to comment to some of that.
Sure. I don't have, chapter and verse on what's happened to the Tea Party movement that I could cite here, but as a general strategy, certainly, it works. You can take over movements through funding, through organization, through leadership, through connections, as you say, and make it seem as if you are continuing to help that movement walk down a certain road, when in fact you're really kind of diverting it. See, and that is often what happens, especially because I know about American politics and American politics. It happens all over the world, but it certainly happens in American politics. You get that sort of thing. The point here is that the acid test would come in this sort of way. A politician comes on the scene, okay? Pick a state, Nevada. He's going to run for Congress. He makes speeches. He says he's for limited government. He says he's for personal liberty. He wants to stop tax and spend. Okay, maybe you live in Nevada. Maybe you have other concerns, which he doesn't speak to, but these concerns sound pretty good, and what he's saying sounds pretty good. And you marshal behind him, and you say, well, let's try this out. And lo and behold, in an upset, he wins the election, and he goes to Washington. Continue to follow the man in Washington and see what he does. See what he does. Because, look at it this way. Any congressman who would be elected and go to Washington on a platform of limited government would, by implication, vote against 99.9% of all bills that would come before the Congress, something like that, somewhere in that ballpark, strictly on the basis that, A, the bill is certainly not limiting the power of federal government, and B, is actually in some way expanding it. So is your new bright star from Nevada actually following that pattern or not? Then you would know whether or not he was telling you the truth when he was campaigning. And in fact, if you follow this, you come to see that, unfortunately, the vast majority of these people do not follow through on what they say they represent. That's a problem, folks. That's a big problem, because they're talking the talk, but they're not walking the walk. And that situation leads to all kinds of inferences about outside interference, covert influences, pressure, misrepresentation from the get-go, all sorts of things. And I'm taking here a very practical, you might even say, in a sense, non-conspiratorial view of these things, based on an acid test. You can see what the result is. Once the person goes to Washington, we have this guy, Scott Brown, who was Jesus Christ for a day. He won an election, and he said he would vote against Obama's massive monstrosity of a health care plan. Okay. And he won somehow in the state of Massachusetts, where Democrats always win. So he went to Washington. We don't know yet on how he's going to vote on the final version of the health plan, but we do know already that he's voted for Obama's jobs plan right out of the box, voted with the Democrats on that. And from what I've seen of that jobs plan, it shouldn't even be called really a jobs plan. It's fairly pathetic. It doesn't, in my view, create lots and lots of jobs. So right away, we have a few suspicions about this guy. Who is he really? What is he going to do? Is he really for limited government? Does he really want to stop government out of control spending as he said he did? Well, we'll see. You just follow his career. You track his votes. It can be done online. Every bill that comes up, you see how he votes on it. You see what the bill really was. And that begins to tell you a story, which is not a new story, because you could do this retrospectively, you see. You could go back 10 years, 20 years, and you could actually follow the careers of various politicians, what they said during their campaigns, what they purported to be about, and then how they voted once they got elected. Very simple. I mean, you would think that large numbers of political writers in this country would be onto this, onto this ingenious idea, and begin to inform the public on what's really happening to their votes. But no, doesn't really happen in any consistent way. I did it once a number of years ago with a particular politician in L.A. And tracked all of his votes since he was elected to the Congress. And I found a couple that were rather mysterious, and I asked him about it, and he kind of looked at me, and he said, "You really did your homework, didn't you, to figure out that one?" And I said, "Yeah, I looked through every vote that you've cast since you got into the Congress." Well, why should that be so unusual? Why can't we have that kind of coverage where a reporter sits down with a congressman or a senator and says, "Okay, you've been in the Congress now for 5 years. I've got in front of me here quotes from your campaign speeches, and I've got a list here of all the votes on all the bills that you have made since you've been elected. And I want to compare and contrast and ask you questions." Well, if the guy's honest, the politician, he's going to sit still for that. And he's going to try to pony up an answer. But we don't see this happening. And I'm afraid that in a majority of cases, if you were to do this kind of tracking, you would be disappointed. You would be disappointed in the promises versus the votes. So this is the problem at a ground level with the political process in America, at a ground level. Because if you look at it, I mean, suppose, for example, you could get somehow, by some miracle, a majority of members of Congress who not only said they were for limited government, but they actually were. And then they all began voting no on just about everything, based on the fact that these bills were against limited government. you would have a revolution. You would have something that would drive the media in this country absolutely insane, with a few exceptions who would be very enthusiastic. But for the most part, you would be driving the media insane. They would almost be jumping out of windows. And if you began to interview these congressmen and asking them why they voted against this and against that, and if they were rational people and sane, they would simply explain it to you. Well, you see, I campaigned on limited government. Let me explain what limited government means by referring to the Constitution. And now, not only would you be changing the political process, you'd be educating the public on exactly what the Constitution said and why it said it. Now you would have an actual revolution in the country.
You really would. And, you know, that's one of the things that one towering example that comes to mind when you talk about that is the way Ron Paul explains how and why he votes the way that he does. And so many times it's all of the rest of them voting one way and him the one dissenting vote. And he says simply, I use my measuring stick as the Constitution. Is it constitutional or not? No, it's not. I'm not voting against it. So, you know, no matter how wonderful it is and all the platitudes and, oh, we've got to do this and all that stuff, if it's unconstitutional, it's not going to be voted for. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, see, because suppose you had 150 guys like him in the Congress. Now, Ron Paul, in the last, I would say, I don't know, 6 years or so, I mean, he's not a media star, but he's gotten a lot more exposure. And it's been what you could call compulsory for the media simply because, you know, there's been a lot of talk about him, and he's got a lot of supporters, and the supporters are very vocal and very loyal. So he's broken through one of the lower ceilings on the media rung so that he can explain his positions, and that's what he does when he's interviewed. He's not there to, you know, be inflammatory particularly. That's not his style. He's kind of a quiet guy. So imagine if you had 150 guys, each with their own personality, but each of them well-versed in the Constitution, doing that in media interviews to their constituents, in speeches, to their fellow members in Congress, saying, no, 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 no. You see, this bill that you think is a good thing because, quote, it helps people, really doesn't have anything to do with the role of the federal government. State government? Maybe. Federal government? Absolutely not. Never did. It's basically unconstitutional. So while I understand that perhaps you feel that we must vote yes on this, because it, quote, helps people, this is not the role of the government. Now, where this really gets dicey is in foreign policy. Because, first of all, at least from my reading of the Constitution, there is some leeway granted in foreign policy to the chief executive, president. But number two, most politicians, no matter what they say, are knee-jerk reactionists when it comes to foreign policy, which means the United States' actions as a government toward other nations, toward other governments, toward other populations, especially but not limited to war. Now it's really a circus. And this is where Ron Paul distinguishes himself from many other so-called conservatives, I would say most, because he's willing to look at these issues and talk about them without feeling some sort of compulsion to wave the flag in one direction or another. And so he is challenging wars on the basis of being illegitimate, ill-advised, counter to the goals of the nation. And he makes a case for it. So imagine what would happen if there were 150 like him in the Congress when it came to foreign policy.
It'd be amazing. It really would.
Yeah, I mean, the uproar in the executive branch alone would be titanic. The president would almost be screaming at the top of his lungs, what am I here for then, if it's not to issue these orders and actions and demands and commands and, you know, so forth and so on. And the president, his staff, cabinet members, the aides, I mean, you know, it goes on and on and on and on and on. What would these people be doing? They would be checking into mental institutions, some of them. It would just drive them totally out of their minds, to say nothing of the media and so on and so forth. And the rationale, time and time again, would be, well, we're just returning to the principles of the Constitution.
It would almost be like New World Order, game over.
Yeah, it would be, wouldn't it? You know, I have an article here that I haven't published yet. Maybe I put it on my website, I can't remember. It's one of these things where you do a little research and then you come up with some numbers and you can't believe your eyes. I mean, you just can't believe your eyes. And you say, I must have made a mistake in addition, in multiplication. But for a while now, I've been trying to count up the number of people in the United States that work for the government. And the other day, I came across an article in the Washington Post that mentioned the number of employees that work for the federal government. And it was based on a study that was done recently. I don't have the whole article in front of me, but it factored in military, it factored in everybody that in any way works for the federal government. But the one thing that it sort of innovated is that it counted all the employees of companies who are government contractors. And we can, I think, pretty well assume that the majority of these companies would be going out of business if they didn't, you know, get the money from government contracts. So in a sense, all those people are government employees too. And it came up with some kind of a figure, you know, I don't remember, maybe 14 million people. And so that sort of re-inspired me to go looking again, and I went down into the state governments, and I discovered that the 2008 census, U.S. Census, actually lists by category the number of people who work full or part-time for state governments. Of course, those census figures don't calculate employees of companies who are state government contractors. They don't include that, so those figures would even be higher. Anyway, I tallied all this up and retallied it and rethought it and retallied it again because I didn't believe my eyes. Because it turns out that in the United States, according to my figures, one out of every nine people work for the government. One out of nine. One out of nine.
Scary.
You know, I mean, that is just... So I went back and I said, okay, let's go back to the 13 colonies. Population roughly 2.5 million. So if we were to take all the state, the colony governments all together at that time, of course, there was no federal government, what would that mean? that would mean that we had something on the order of 277,000 people working for the colonial governments of the 13 colonies out of 2.5 million. And so my first thought was, well, that alone would have been cause for revolution. Forget King George or England or anything. You know, people would have just, you know, gone to war right on the spot because they would have recognized instantaneously that some gigantic scam was being perpetrated. You know, how could it be humanly possible that these 277,000 people spread through the 13 colonies had something to do every day for 8 hours that was important to the survival of the colonists and the colonies? Impossible. They would have revolted on the spot. But that's the proportion that we're talking about now. And so what do you get when you get that kind of proportion in modern day terms? What does that mean? Well, it means that one out of nine people is working for the man, to use a phrase out of the 60s. Working for the man, getting his paycheck from the man. Knows which side of his bread is buttered. Knows what to do, what to think, what to say. Who to support, who not to support. You've got all these people in the United States. Divide 9 into 308 million, and you'll have the number of people in the United States working for the government on some level. And you'll know what these people stand for and support. Now, you're right, Earl, that's scary. That is scary. That tells you where the country is heading. And so every time that a bill is passing through Congress that's going to create yet another bureaucracy or another wing on another bureaucracy, just count that as more people being co-opted into the system.
Get the quote, but somebody talked about when liberty is dead, when you have more people that are parasitic on the system than those that are supporting it, and then it will totally collapse. I think it's probably lower than half.
But, yeah, lower than half.
I can't remember the quote. Yeah.
So here's where we are. Yeah. Uh-huh. That's right.
Because their sustenance comes from, ostensibly, you know, it on the backs of those that put into the system. Of course, we know with the phony fractional reserve banking, the Federal Reserve and all of that, we've got another layer of stuff going on. But anyway.
Yeah, but it's not all tax money. In other words, it's invented money on top of tax money.
Yeah. It's further robbing of the people of their sustenance, you know, making their money worthless, and it will come to roost. It will definitely, it already has to some extent, but not to the extent that it will one day as time goes on.
That's right.
I'm wondering, I have some questions that have come in on the Internet. I don't know if you want to go into those now or maybe kind of finish where you were.
No. I think I've stated that case, so sure,
okay.
Feel free.
Great. Let's do that because it'd be great to see what people are thinking and wanting to know out there. And I also want to invite, before we launch into that, anyone who does have a question they'd like to pose to John, then if you're on the phone line, just dial *2 on your phone keypad, and we can unmute you, your line, and let you speak with John. Or if you're listening via the Internet, there's a small question box underneath the link. Just type your question in there and submit it to us, and we'll be glad to make sure that question gets asked. And we'll start with Alan Hampton in Russellville, Arkansas. Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, Article 1, Section 2, Clause 1, the House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, Article 1, Section 7, Clause 1, all bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives. Well, there's no question there. I'm not sure. Did you have any comment to that, John, or I'm not sure where
they're
going?
Well, I'm not sure what the implication of that those statements are, but, you know, there has been a move recently, I would say somewhat small movement, to say that actually the members of Congress should be selected by state legislatures, since the states are primarily the feeder system into the federal government, that the federal government, in a sense, yes, represents the people, but also represents the states. And so if each state legislature was looking out for itself and its own state primarily, then the people that they would be selecting to send to Congress would be of necessity in favor of limited government. And the 10th Amendment in particular, you know, those powers not enumerated specifically to the federal government shall belong or shall be reserved for the states. And there is some sense to that argument, except that I believe that the system in practice has become so corrupted in recent times that trying to redo the system that way really wouldn't help. You would still get this incredible federalism that we live under these days. I don't think it would make all that much difference. Although I'll have to rethink that a little bit. There are a lot of states in the union that might well begin to assert themselves and realize that they should be about state power as opposed to federal power. And who knows what that might produce. So I don't know whether that was perhaps the implication in the question, but that's my best reply.
Okay. And if Alan did mean to infer something additional, certainly you're welcome, Alan, to clarify or state further where we can go from there. This is kind of apropos. Frank in Long Beach, he participates a lot. To quote Ron Paul, truth is treason in an empire of lies. I love that. Once people have awakened from their somnambulistic states, how do we prevent the citizenry from falling back to sleep when Joseph Goebbels exists in TV commercials, TV programming, as well as other mass media formats? That's a good one for you, John.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't have a magical answer for that, but I think from what I was saying before about ground-level politics in the country, an enormous effort on the part of citizens to hold their representatives accountable is one answer. Because this tracking system that I'm proposing, which, you know, is just common sense. You send somebody to Washington, you want to know what they're doing. And if they're doing something you don't like because they've now broken their promise, then you let them know immediately and in organized terms that they're going to be voted out of office. Unfortunately, at least in the House, that means every 2 years. So after 6 months, one of these phonies who's serving a first term in Congress could be made to realize in no uncertain terms that he's in his last term, that he's already rejected because of how he's voted. Now, can this be done? Yes, it can be. Is it enormous effort? Yes. Does it take organization? Yes. But it's there. I mean, the door is not completely shut on that. But, you know, we're talking about hard work here.
Absolutely. Okay. We've got, okay, this is, it's anonymous, so I'm not sure who it is, but if you're the one that wanted your phone line unmuted, I've just done so. Are you there, guest?
Am I on?
You are on. There you are.
Well, how about that? Okay, this is full participation. Very good. I'm joining you, yes, on the conference call line. There are two things that I wanted to mention. I'm not trying to polarize this, but the Constitution Party is the only one that I know of that is working on elimination of job security for government employees. And, you know, I don't think that it's very fair that the government employees, not only does the government experience no competition, but I don't think it's very fair that government employees have job security when we the people don't. So that's the first point. And the second point is that I actually see labor unions through the National Labor Relations Act. I actually see that as an extension of government employment, and I'll tell you why. I think it's really, really backwards when you have employees through the labor union contract dictating to their employer the terms and conditions of their employment, or even to be in equal standing with them in doing so. And as far as I'm concerned, if a labor union contract has the ability to guarantee an employee minus market conditions job security, I think that that's something else that, you know, that ought to be eliminated. As far as I'm concerned, you know, no job security for anybody except what the free market dictates that that you can have.
Okay. Well, I don't disagree on either point. I mean, I fully agree on your first point. Historically, my position about unions would be, at one time, there was no question that workers in the United States were being treated badly by employers of certain companies, very badly. And in order to gain a foothold, they formed unions. And they began to assert power so that they could obtain a decent wage. And historically, I don't think there's any question that the union movement contributed to the rise of the middle class in America, which is not a bad thing at all. But where I part company with this is, number one, government unions, which seems almost like a redundancy to me, the existence of government unions. And two, and I'm not being specific here about legislation or details because I don't know them, but there comes a tipping point where a union is now, as you say, dictating terms, is making it perhaps very, very difficult, or in some cases even impossible, to fire somebody or to stage a kind of, you know, armed robbery of the employer by demanding that this has to happen, and this has to happen, this has to happen, this has to happen, that has to happen. And that is pure insanity. And I remember a long time ago when I was in my early 20s, I had a friend who worked at a radio station in New York. And, you know, he was just breaking in, working his butt off every day to get ahead in the business. Very talented, very ambitious, had almost, you know, no cachet at the radio station. But got himself into a position where he began to move up the ladder in production. And he would come home, and we were buddies, and he would talk to me, and he would say, these union dudes, they're sitting around. They're doing nothing. in production. They're supposed to be involved with sound and sets and this and that, and they're doing nothing, 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 and they're getting paid. I could be making that money, and I'm working my butt off. So whatever it takes to derail that and to derail the whole sense of unions being able to put a business out of business and to tip the seesaw in the opposite direction, away from the company and onto themselves, even if it bankrupts the company. I mean, this is just psychosis. And whatever has to be done to stop that, it should certainly be done. But one of the points that you implied here, I thought you were going to go in that direction, which I see now adds to my previous statement, is in many cases, in a way, because of these contracts and these laws that were passed at a federal level, you can, without a lot of a stretch of imagination, begin to count many, 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 many union workers throughout the United States as employees of the federal government, if you really want to be honest about it.
But my stretch is that the National Labor Relations Act, you know, is unconstitutional, and therefore the jobs and the job security that it creates, as far as I'm concerned. You know, if you want to let the states do that, then let the people in the states argue about whether labor unions should be allowed in that state, but definitely, you know, not at the federal level.
Okay, I understand. I'm just not conversant enough with the National Labor Relations Act to say absolutely I agree with you, or I have these, exceptions that I'd like to state. I've given you my position as clearly as I can, and I thank you because you point out something very important here. And the fact that there does exist a political party dedicated to the Constitution, to the degree that that is exactly what that party is doing, that's a very good thing.
Absolutely. It is. Thank you very much. I guess, was there any final question or clarification, or was that it?
No, that he amply entertained the topic, and it does need to be explored further, but probably not on this call.
Sure.
Yeah.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
Okay, and we'll what we'll do is move to some more questions that have come on the internet. I know we're approaching the hour point. John, is your time okay to take a few more, or you've got a pretty?
I can take a few more. You know, before we do that, I forgot to mention that I have a new radio show on the internet, so maybe I can give
Good.
Out that website to people.
Sure, do that.
Every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Pacific time for an hour, I'm now doing a radio show. It's called the Progressive Radio Network, and it's www.progressiveradionetwork.com. And if you go there and search around, you can find me. You can click on the listen button and catch the show live. They also archive all the shows. And I'm mainly trying to interview people that I consider innovators, people who run against the grain of, the usual cultural brainwashing on many fronts and expose their work to the public. So feel free to tune in and bring your friends. And as I said, all the shows are archived, so you can always pick up on old shows there too. Sure, let's take maybe a couple more, and then I think I have to go.
Okay, let's see. We have here, hold on just a second. Let me scroll to that. Okay, Alan Hampton, Russellville, Arkansas. Constitutionally, the only reason anyone is elected to any public office is to honor the oath of office. Electing someone on a campaign promise is surefire destruction of constitutional America. Voters are obligated to enforce the oath of office. Well, I think we'd agree to that. I don't think there's much more to be said.
Yeah, I would say that's true. Although obviously, during a campaign, the voters would expect the candidate to flesh out, in a sense, what that oath means in terms of the times that we are living in. You know, if you swear an oath to the Constitution, then, of course, you say that, and then you say, and this is what that's going to mean if you send me to Washington. And from that point on, you see, I mean, you've got to track this guy. I mean, come on. You know, a party doesn't exist just to elect people, or it does, but it shouldn't. A real party is also going to demand, or should, from the people who are elected, that they abide by the principles of the party. And, of course, if you're part of a party that has no principles, then you're in clover. You know, everything's great. But if the party is not going to do it, the citizens have to do it. And, of course, it always falls to the people anyway to do that, to hold the guy's feet to the fire, to say to him during the campaign, look, we want you to tell us what you're going to do when you get to Washington. And in fact, here's 10 questions that we have about bills that are either pending or coming up or could come up on subjects as large as cap and tax, health care, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we want to know what you're going to do when they do come up. We want to know exactly. And we're going to be watching you when you go. And if you screw with us, then it's your last term. You're done. And we will lay on such a publicity campaign that, you know, you'll be needing to move to another state after you're drummed out of office. I mean, that kind of thing. Because, as I said at the outset here, the structure of a republic, the American republic, and consequently the state governments as well, they are all based on a model of distrust. This is not share and care, and we're all in this together, and isn't it wonderful, and let's try to bridge the gap and reach across the aisle. And all of this nonsense has nothing to do with the way government actually was originally structured in the United States. It was all based on a tremendous aversion toward, fear of, justified fear of, anger at top-down central planning, coercive, intrusive, invasive governments. That's what it was always all about. So all of the sort of, you know, joy and happiness and flag waving and, you know, glorious whatchamacallit that accompanies these political campaigns is really completely beside the point on that level alone. We're not trying to have a party, you know, a circus to send a guy to Washington. We're trying to hold somebody's feet to the fire so that limited government is a fact and not just a fairy tale that was told in 1776. Okay. One more, and then I got to go, Earl.
Okay. Vanessa in Stevenson, Alabama asked, can you please repeat the website? And someone else asked, can you spell your name? They want the correct spelling of your name.
Sure. J-O-N, John. Rappaport is R-A-P-P-O-P-O-R-T. Rappaport. The website, I've got several, www.insolutions.com. InSolutions, InSolutions.info, and then my original website is www.nomorefakenews.com. So What you're going to find on these websites to one degree or another is I'm active in many areas, not just as a reporter. And some of what I offer in terms of seminars and CDs and information, you might, you know, leap up and down, enjoy at, or you might be just completely indifferent to. Who knows? But you will find articles that I write on politics and health and government news, and that's kind of what we've been talking about here today, so that's what you can expect. And thank you, Earl, as always. I really, this
yes.
was a real good one.
Yes, well, I appreciate it too, and I wanted to let everybody know that you'll be speaking on the topic, The Deepest, Darkest Secrets of Medical Fraud, at the 2010 Health Freedom Expo at the Long Beach Convention Center. And that's coming up the end of March. Get the information on that at healthfreedomexpo.com. And we'll be there in booth 512 representing Republic Magazine. Thanks again,
actually,
John.
I'll be speaking at 11 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, the 28th of March. I just found that out. So.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, that's good. And we'll look forward to that very much. And I thank everybody for joining us today, and certainly join us next week when we have another incredible lineup. And we'll look forward to meeting you again, John, at the expo next month as well.
Absolutely.
And with that, thank you, everybody, and we will see you all next week. This officially ends our webinar. Have a great rest of the day. Bye-bye.
The moderator has left the conference.